Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Justice Department looks like it might pin a $13 billion fine on J.P. Morgan Chase for its role in the financial collapse and ensuing recession. But are they getting off easy? Wall Street media cheerleaders are saying Chase is being punished for things they didn't even do. But is that right? We'll talk to economics blogger Eve Smith of the website Naked Capitalism. Also on Counterspin today, CNN will air a pro-nuclear power documentary on November 7th. Pandora's Promise is described by the New York Times as stacked as advocate movies get, a parade of like-minded nuclear power advocates who assure us that everything will be all right. Why would a news channel air propaganda? The group Beyond Nuclear has been fact-checking Pandora's Promise claims. We'll talk to the group's founder, Linda Gunter. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch both issued reports that shed considerable light on the civilian deaths caused by U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen. Their findings, if not shocking, are certainly important. Two attacks in Pakistan that killed 19 civilians. A grandmother killed while picking vegetables with her grandchildren. Of the drone strikes that were studied in Yemen, most of the dead were civilians. The groups held a press conference in Washington, D.C. to announce their findings. On that day, October 21st, the reports were on the front page of the New York Times. But those reports were not even mentioned on the network newscasts, which each reach millions of viewers. The newscasts have a little over 20 minutes to give you all the important news of the day, so it's understandable that some stories might fall through the cracks. But look at what they did have time for. ABC, CBS, and NBC all covered the new Apple product announcements. NBC had a long report about family farm tourist destinations, as well as a report about a construction project at the U.S. Capitol building. That was also apparently newsworthy over at CBS, where viewers saw part of a Warren Buffett interview that the network would be airing the very next day. ABC World News led with the big news that gas prices are a little lower, a possible UFO sighting in Iceland, the most popular baby names, and a long report on a school that helps prepare dogs for air travel. Now, it's not that all of that is totally frivolous, but next to a major investigation of your country's secretive bombing campaigns, it's hard to imagine how one could consider these stories more newsworthy. Now, there were several exceptions in the big media. CNN host Jake Tapper interviewed Amnesty International drone researcher Mustafa Kadri, who also appeared on the PBS NewsHour in a debate with a retired U.S. general. Elsewhere on cable news, though, the drone reports do not appear to have been mentioned on the main primetime shows on either the liberal-leaning MSNBC or the conservative Fox News channel. Apparently, the two have found some common ground there.
Could the government shutdown make the media better? If you heard Face the Nation's Bob Schieffer on October 20th, you might think so. He was highlighting a nearby takeout sandwich shop that suffered because government workers were home instead of on the job.
A big story like the shutdown tends to push things that often matter off the front pages in TV. Here's just one that got almost no attention. A survey out last week showed nearly half the students in our public schools, 48%, come from families so poor they qualify for free or reduced price meals. Even more disgraceful, a majority of students now qualify for food subsidies in 17 states across the South and West. I'd like to see our elected officials begin to focus on how we fix things like that. Like my friend at the carryout, I'm losing interest in who wins the partisan games.
More coverage of poverty, a grossly neglected subject in corporate news media, would be great. And Bob Schieffer hosts a national TV show, so he could do something about it. But right before this very commentary, he talked to two Republican senators and one Democratic senator about the effects of the shutdown and strategic moves by leaders in both major parties. In other words, partisan games. Later, he had a roundtable of Beltway journalists discussing the same thing. In other words, a typical week at Face the Nation, where the most popular guest of all time is Senator John McCain, and the other guests are mostly white, male, Republican lawmakers and establishment journalists. If Schieffer's really fed up with partisan games and pines to discuss poverty and inequality, he should go for it. But that would mean, at the very least, he'll need to seek out some new guests.
USA Today front-paged a piece October 21st about the era of catastrophic wildfires in the West. Some 6,700 fires have burned over 1 million acres of federal land since January, the paper reported, diverting U.S. Forest Service money from recreation and land management programs. So what's behind the problem? Readers got one sentence of explanation, quote, "Heavy fuel loads, intensive fire suppression, and urban sprawl have led to an era of superfires over ranges of ponderosa pine," close quote. Now, if you feel like something's missing from that list, you aren't alone. Here's another source on the matter. Quote, "Climate change will likely cause more frequent wildfires in the western United States within the next 30 years and throughout North America and most of Europe by the end of the century, primarily because of higher temperatures, scientists report," close quote. Actually, that sentence comes from the very same source. That's from USA Today back in June. In fact, the paper's done a lot of engaging with the realities of climate change in a dedicated series called Weathering the Change. But pieces like this recent one suggest the knowledge is somehow constrained to that section and weirdly invisible in other parts of the paper.
What does the world think of Iran's nuclear program? That answer might depend on whether you are a U.S. journalist for whom the world doesn't really mean the world, but a small number of powerful Western nations. Take PBS NewsHour anchor Ray Suarez, who explained on October 16th that while Iran insists that it is only interested in peaceful nuclear power, quote, "The rest of the world has been saying, if you need those things, we will get them for you and don't want you to enrich," close quote. If by the rest of the world one means the U.S., Israel, and the countries on the U.N. Security Council, Suarez would be correct. But if he actually means the rest of the world, he's wrong. The non-aligned movement, representing 120 countries and more than half the world's population, has consistently backed Iran's right to enrich uranium for a civilian nuclear program, as it has also supported the abolition of all nuclear weapons, something elite media tend not to notice because they obviously don't count.
And finally, media sometimes feel the need to identify supposed threats to the United States. That colors much of the coverage of Iran, to be sure. And you see it elsewhere, too. Take this New York Times story on October 21st about the global arms market. This story emphasized China's role as an emerging weapons dealer. Their sales volume, according to one report, jumped by 162% from 2008 to 2012, as the Times explains. China now ranks as the fifth largest arms dealer in the world. Now, maybe that is supposed to sound worrying. Stories like this often imply, if not state outright, that these developments could challenge U.S. dominance. But some context is called for here, and unfortunately, the Times mostly doesn't deliver what readers need. The most obvious question, how does this compare to the United States? The Times tells readers that the U.S. has a 39% share of the total arms market in the world. That leaves readers to do a little bit of work to figure out what that might mean. Put in simpler terms, the U.S. is still far and away the biggest arms dealer in the world. The number two country, Russia, has about a 15% share of the global market. But doing direct country comparisons could undermine the whole point. As the Times points out, this new surge in arms sales means that China has now surpassed Canada and Sweden on the international arms market. That's right. China is even more threatening than Sweden.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
Word has floated out that the Justice Department has possibly reached a settlement with JPMorgan Chase over some fraudulent mortgage lending practices. The details at this point aren't entirely clear, but the amounts that have been thrown around, first $11 billion, then maybe $13 billion, have led some people to wonder why the government is picking on Chase and its formerly Golden Boy CEO, Jamie Dimon. Is Chase really being made to pay billions of dollars mostly for things it didn't even do, though? And is Dimon being punished for criticizing the Obama administration? Blogger Eve Smith of Naked Capitalism joins us now to talk about this. Eve Smith, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
Now, with any story that's based mostly on leaks, it makes sense to try to figure out who the leaks are coming from. You wrote a piece saying that there's a reason to believe that some of these details serve both sides. Chase can be portrayed or can portray itself as a victim. The Justice Department gets to look tough by slapping a big fine on the biggest bank. Once you start breaking down these numbers, though, $13 billion doesn't add up to as much money as $13 billion sounds like, it seems.
That's correct. I mean, one of the reasons that the numbers are so large or look so large is that this is a multiple settlements rolled up into one, whereas most of the banks have settled different things separately. So you've heard $2 billion here, $3 billion there, whereas this is one settlement of multiple cases, the biggest of which most banks haven't settled with the government yet. It's violations for what is called put-back liability for loans made to Fannie and Freddie. And put-back basically means that the loan wasn't what it was promised to be, and when the borrower got in trouble, the government puts the loan back and demands, you know, the loan turns out to be worth, you know, only 30% or 40%, or it could be total loss. The government puts back the loan and demands that the bank either replace it with a good loan, or that they give the money back, and so that's the biggest component of the settlement, and that's $4 billion. Another component, which is that's actually one of the few places where we have a hard number, because that was actually already entered into with the regulator for Fannie and Freddie and J.P. Morgan. Another piece, which is the rest of the pieces are rumored. Mm-hmm. The next large piece is another $4 billion, which is supposedly for various forms of borrower relief. We had similar provisions in the various big mortgage settlements that were entered into in 2011 and 2012. Those have actually proven to have very little economic value. They're mainly compensating the bank for a lot of window dressing. They're mainly paying the bank for things they either would have done anyhow or things they should have been doing all along. I mean, for instance, banks have been turning over in places like Cleveland. They've been turning over houses to the city to be bulldozed. They literally get credit for that. In the big settlement, they got the biggest way that the banks met their total for borrower relief was via short sales. A short sale of some are things they should have been approving all along, but they couldn't be bothered because they were a little bit of extra work. So those are the kind of, you know, a lot of people regard those as junk credits. And the thing that people have gotten the most upset about is actually based on complete misinformation. There's been a lot of claims floating around the financial media that, oh, J.P. Morgan is being punished for having acquired two sick institutions that were deeply involved in the mortgage business, Bear Stearns and Washington Mutual. In fact, the only fines in this deal are not based on, which is about $2 to $3 billion, are not based on any Bear Stearns or Washington Mutual behavior. They're based strictly on J.P. Morgan behavior.
Now, that's the line that I've heard most often. CNN's Aaron Burnett said this, that in the heat of the financial crisis, the government came to Jamie Dimon and said, you have to buy these two companies, Bear Stearns, Washington Mutual. We know there's all kinds of problems with them, but for the sake of the country, you must do this. Aaron Burnett called it his patriotic duty. And now the government is saying, oh, we're going to assess fines based on the fact that you bought these two sickly institutions. You're saying that that's completely off base.
That's absolutely false. First thing, it's absolutely false. And second, the idea that the government forced J.P. Morgan to buy these institutions and that they were a bad deal is also false. When J.P. Morgan, in fact, spent a lot of there's a line among investors, when the government's on the side of the – when the government is selling, I want to be the one buying. it's usually perceived that, that buying from the government is a fantastic deal. That happened, that that was the case the last time we had a mortgage crisis and a savings and loan crisis when people bought, when various investors bought from the Resolution Trust Corporation. They made boatloads of money. In this case, when Jamie Dimon bought Washington Mutual, the bank had $40 billion in equity. They paid $1.9 billion, and they already reserved for losses at the time of the sale. They reserved for $36 billion in losses. So they were the idea that they were going to take future losses on Washington Mutual was booked into the assumption. Even with that, J.P. Morgan booked $2 billion in profit the minute they bought that bank. And now they've reversed some of those reserves. In the last quarter, they reversed $750 million of reserves of WaMu losses. They've made even more money on it than they originally expected.
I've seen someone say that the Bear Stearns building itself in New York City is valued at as much as the total price that they paid for the company.
That's correct. And similarly, they had big loss for Bear reserves for Bear Reserve. And the government stood to take $29 billion of losses. That's before Dimon took a penny of losses. So the idea that these were bad economic deals is just nonsense. Dimon was laughing his way to the bank. He's occasionally grumbled, and I suspect that that's because somebody chided him for initially doing too many high fives for what a good deal he got, that made the government look bad.
Now, pulling back big picture, one of the criticisms all along has been that Wall Street really hasn't paid a price for its role in causing the financial meltdown. This potential fine, again, people look at the headlines, they see $13 billion, they see it from a big bank, and they think, well, we're getting something finally. It's, I guess, the appearance of accountability, but it sounds like no one in particular is really being held responsible here, at least as far as we know so far.
Well, and that's actually one of the complaints that people have made all the way through the crisis, that no individuals have been prosecuted and hardly ever have even paid a civil fine. I mean, it's really appalling the degree to which that individuals have not been held accountable, because there is one point that's sort of fair that the critics of this process make, is that these fines actually effectively hurt the shareholders, not the individuals who are responsible for the conduct. We've got a very defective corporate governance system in America where shareholders are disempowered. You know, for instance, there was a huge outcry in 2009 about the bonuses that Goldman Sachs was prepared to pay, and a bunch of institutional shareholders met with Goldman to try to pressure them to pay less in bonuses. That didn't happen. You know, and similarly, we have these huge fines that are being paid in this case, and yet there's no consequence there. You know, there are no significant consequences for Jamie Dimon. You know, if you believe the theory that this was so horrible for the bank, you would expect the board to be all after Jamie Dimon. There's no sign of that at all. I mean, in contrast, when Barclays paid a mere $450 million fines for LIBOR violation, its CEO was out.
Now, finally, again, the details of this are still unknown, but is there any sense that this is the end of the government's investigations into J.P. Morgan Chase? Is this effectively an agreement that says, okay, we'll give you this money and no more?
Oh, no. It's only the end of it in the mortgage space. Mm-hmm. The sort of stunning thing that doesn't get the attention that it should is that J.P. Morgan stands alone of all the other banks in having a tremendous number of violations, regulatory violations, in all of its businesses ex mortgages. It's really, one analyst called it an out of control bank. So we could still have headlines in lots of other businesses. It's just that in the mortgage area it looks to have put it to bed.
We've been speaking with Eve Smith. You can read her work at her blog, nakedcapitalism.com. Eve Smith, thanks for joining us on Counterspin today.
Thank you.
CNN is planning to air a pro-nuclear power propaganda film on November 7th. Pandora's Promise features a one-sided view of the nuclear debate by profiling several people who were allegedly once critical of nuclear power, but have come around to support it. New York Times film reviewer Manola Dargis wrote that Pandora's Promise is as stacked as advocate movies get. that it leaves no room for dissent, much less a drop of doubt, and she concluded that it was a parade of like-minded nuclear power advocates who assure us that everything will be all right. So why would an alleged news organization air such a film? We're joined by Linda Gunter, founder of Beyond Nuclear and the group's media director. You can see Beyond Nuclear's debunkings of Pandora's Promise at beyondnuclear.org. Welcome to Counterspin, Linda Gunter.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, your group has taken on several claims and characterizations found in Pandora's Promise. Tell us about Beyond Nuclear's take on the documentary.
Well, we feel that this is a film straight out of the propaganda playbook because Robert Stone went about it by establishing his thesis first and then finding people with rather spurious credentials to support it. He never talked to anybody who really understands or has a long history or is credentialed and authentic on the issue from the medical community, the scientific community at all, let alone put them in his film. So all he did was find people who could support his, as he says, point of view, but then goes on to claim that it's based on sound science and investigative journalism, neither of which it is. And the other premise, I think, is that he originally claimed that it featured former leaders of the anti-nuclear movement, a statement he pulled after we attacked it, who have changed their mind. But there is nothing to suggest in all the research we've done that any of these people were certainly never leaders of the anti-nuclear movement, and it's hard to know whether they were even anti-nuclear.
Well, Beyond Nuclear would know if they had been leaders in that movement, right?
Right. They would be familiar to us and familiar to many people in the movement. They've also positioned this as something that a film that will start a pro-nuclear movement, which is kind of laughable, considering, in fact, what they're advocating, because nobody is interested in the design that they are trying to push of reactor in the film. But also, it's sort of a propaganda technique to say, you know, if we say something is so, then it is. But in reality, there's no major switch from true environmentalists to pro-nuclear positions, which is a claim they also make in their publicity.
You mentioned the director of Pandora's Promise, Robert Stone. We don't have time to enumerate all of the problems with the film, but one thing really bothered me. Stone is quoted in Forbes saying of Fukushima, quote, "Nobody has died and no one has gotten sick from radiation and no one ever will," close quote. Similarly, one of the film's subjects, Mark Linus, says Fukushima will probably never kill anyone. That struck me as curious, considering the epidemiology on radiation exposure. Can you respond to that notion that nobody is going to die from Fukushima?
Well, I think it's more than curious. It's actually callous and completely wrong. I mean, it goes against all the known accepted medical facts, starting with the National Academy of Sciences, who say that there is no dose low enough to be safe, no dose of exposure to radiation that's low enough ever to be safe. And we know that long-term exposure to low doses of radiation cause all number of problems, cancer included, not just fatalities, but also illnesses, birth defects. It affects the DNA. You know, we're talking about, internal doses of cesium and strontium, not eating a banana, which is one of the things, you know, one of the red herrings that comes up in this film, which is full of easy sound bites that to an audience who decides not to question or challenge it may seem very compelling. But why this film is propaganda is that it completely omits the reality and the facts about the science and the medicine of Fukushima and Chernobyl and the effects of radiation in general, because if it included them in the film, it would completely blow their thesis out of the water. So they are censoring the story to suit a campaign backed by the Breakthrough Institute to try and create this phony pro-nuclear movement.
Well, I should add that Ed Lyman, writing for the Union of Concerned Scientists, cites a leaked UN study that says that because of the exposure at Fukushima, the doses released at Fukushima, that from 1 to 3,000 people can be predicted to die from those leaks. Now, FAIR, the group that produces Counterspin, is circulating a petition to ask CNN to have a truly balanced debate. Beyond Nuclear has already done this. What was CNN's response?
silence. There was no response. And we not only submitted a petition, we first paid them the courtesy of simply asking them, because we thought, well, maybe they'll say yes. We didn't really believe that. So we wrote, we made phone calls. I made lots of phone calls to LA and to Atlanta. We sent emails to the VP of programming. We submitted the petition by registered mail for which they signed, and that's been that. But you have to remember, I think, you know, this is sort of symptomatic of the sorry state of so-called journalism. And this film is kind of an emblematic example of that, because when you look back to the Iraq War and this unquestioning acceptance of anyone with a tie and a title telling you this is what's happening by CNN and other networks in the mainstream media, you know, backfired on them later when they realized they'd been lied to. And this is exactly the same thing. This is a complete propaganda film that nobody has fact-checked at CNN to see if it even has any modicum of truth about it, which it really doesn't. And they're putting it on as if on a news channel. So I think this is just, you know, unfortunately, the sad direction in which so-called journalism has gone, which is not to ask questions, not to seek facts and truth, but simply to have debates and points of view, but present them as if they are facts and truth.
We've been speaking with Linda Gunter of Beyond Nuclear. You can read the group's extensive critique of Pandora's Promise at beyondnuclear.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Linda Gunter.
Thanks, Steve. It was a pleasure.
And just a short program note, FAIR is circulating its own petition asking CNN to feature a real debate on nuclear power. You can sign on at FAIR.org. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call our toll-free number. That's 1-800-847-3993. Again, 1-800-847-3993. Or go to FAIR.org for more information. That's also where you can listen to Counterspin and subscribe to the Counterspin podcast. And while you're there, sign FAIR's CNN petition demanding the news channel present a balanced debate of nuclear energy. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.